morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with John Malamphy about monasticism. Right now, I would like to welcome Jonathan Batkin. He is the director of the Wheelwright Museum, and he is the curator of the exhibition at the Wheelwright, From the Railroad to Route 66, the Native American Curio Trade in New Mexico. The exhibition runs through April of next year, and he's also author of the fabulous accompanying catalog, I guess you have to call it a book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So the From the Railroad to Route 66, the railroads came into this part of the country in the late 19th century. What were some of the effects of railroad travel as it affected New Mexico, and particularly this area of the curio trade?
Specifically, the railroad, you know, brought tourists, and that is the assumption everybody makes, is that there's a link between tourism and the acquisition of souvenirs or curios in travel destinations. But one of the points I've made for many years with this subject is that equally important for curio dealers is the fact that the rails could haul mail and freight. And so the curio trade was a mail order industry from the inception.
So that's a very interesting distinction. I mean, we think of curio shops as these kind of crazy sprawling places full of blankets and trinkets and all sorts of stuff. What was the mail order end of it?
First, to address what you just said about a shop, the late Harold Gans. Harold just passed away in April, and his life was celebrated in the newspaper, What was mentioned most about him was the fact that he was the voice of Zozobra for many years. His father founded one of the most important shops in Santa Fe, Southwest Arts and Crafts, in 1916. And Harold was an extremely important source for me for this project. The earliest curio store in Santa Fe was founded by Aaron Gold, Moses Aaron Gold, and then assumed by his brother Jake, and then later assumed by J.S. Candelario, who went into partnership with Jake at the turn of the century. And it was the type of shop you're talking about, the sprawling, disastrous-looking mess. And Harold's words in describing what it looked like in the 30s, he said it was the worst junk shop you ever saw in your life, very cleverly done. It was all very deliberate, the looks of the shops, the interiors, the exteriors, and they were very serious business. And the mail order trade here and in many other parts of the country was based on local products of native peoples. So Pueblo Indian pottery, Pueblo figurative ceramics, basketry, textiles, other things made locally would be marketed wholesale to other curio dealers throughout the country to supply their businesses. And then in the same way, the local dealers here also imported from other curio dealers and then offered a much broader range of products to tourists.
What does the word curio mean?
It's simply curiosity, something that's unfamiliar, and it has its roots back many centuries. In the 18th century, as Europeans began to explore the world and collect, they distinguished between natural curiosities and man-made curiosities. So it essentially was anything from a culture that you were not, you know, well-versed in. Unfortunately, it began to take on some negative connotations in the 19th and 20th centuries.
So the types of products that people were selling, that these people in the late 19th, early 20th century were selling in curio shops and selling mail order, what specifically were they, and how to what extent were they authentic versus just simply made for a mass market?
If we were to take the Pueblos, for example, they were still making very traditional types of pottery, water jars, storage jars. And these things
that were utilitarian.
They were utilitarian objects. And they were very beautiful objects. So they had a ready market through the curio trade. And so while the Pueblos were shifting towards the use of metal containers and, you know, other objects to provide those functions in their households, they continued to make these traditional objects, but their market now was the curio market, and they would wholesale their work to traders in Santa Fe, bring their work by literally by the wagon load in a carreta, take their work downtown Santa Fe and sell it or trade it to a curio dealer. And then the mix of objects became tremendous. There were various objects invented for sale through these shops, human figurines, ceramic human figurines, which we treated in an important exhibition in 1999 called Clay People. We believe that they, in fact, were terribly important artistic statements and were expressions of rebellion towards colonialism to a degree. But
and some of those were curios.
Absolutely. And they were sold as, or purchased as, heathen idols, which was never the intent of the maker. There were objects made of discarded things, cheese boxes and scraps from hides that couldn't be used in any other way, and so there were drums and rattles and clubs and all sorts of objects that were made just for the curio trade. They never had any real function in Pueblo life.
It really does bring up questions of authenticity in an era where you have, what looks like Indian art that's actually made in China. This was Indian art made by Indians, but it wasn't authentic in the way that maybe the people who bought it were thinking it was.
That's true. And I'm not the only one to think this. This actually drives some of our exhibition philosophy at the museum. We do think of these things as terribly important objects. And authenticity is kind of a moving target, and even the curio dealers would constantly reinvent the meaning of, or a definition of authenticity. And so they would try to link, they would create stories linking the objects with activities in native life that, in fact, never occurred. I mean,
What's an example of that?
Some of the rattles made by the Pueblos from scraps of hide and with cow tails or horse tails hanging from the ends would be sold by curio dealers as squaw dance rattles. Well, there is no squaw dance. There are no squaws among the Pueblos. There are no squaw dances. This is just all fabricated stuff. And it could be that the original dealer who put them into the trade through the mail order market never promoted them as any such thing. But things only had interest to the public if sold a certain way. So I don't deal much with that in this project. I've dealt with it in a prior article or two. But representing things as, this is your last opportunity to get something from a vanishing race. That was a great theme of the curio trade at the turn of the century. And, obviously that was nonsense, too.
Well, talk more about that, because there's this turn-of-the-century mythology about the Indians as a vanishing race. It seems like, you go in a heartbeat from defeat of a whole people to romanticizing them as these noble vanishing people with beautiful arts.
That's a great question, and it's not something I feel like I can actually address, and I don't know who has attempted to address that, but you're absolutely right that the curio trade and this obsession with buying Indian artifacts comes right on the heels of us attempting to obliterate these peoples from the West. And in fact, I do at least mention this in passing at the very beginning of the book, that the desire for Indian artifacts verged on the irrational. And I don't know what was driving it. It's all a post-Civil War phenomenon, all this, and that's for somebody else to figure out someday. But it is fascinating that the trade just explodes right at the end of the wars, the subjection of all Plains people, putting Plains people on reservations, essentially dismantling Native culture in the West. And people then become obsessed with having some relic of this culture.
Yeah, exactly. It's very strange, and it seems like it's filling some emotional need of the American settlers or the American populace. Mm-hmm. Especially, it's strange enough for tourists who come out here, but it's also like what's going on in the minds of people in Missouri and Maryland and New York who are actually buying this stuff far away.
There is a phenomenon here. The Indian corner or Indian room or Indian den became a popular element of a Victorian home. And there are some scholars who've done some work on the subject. I don't address it at all in this project, but many of these objects were being sold to be incorporated into your collection, your den. People would have a display of artifacts arranged in ways we actually don't understand very well today. There's very little photo documentation of Indian cabinets or Indian corners, Indian dens.
And I'd never thought about it until I read your catalog. It is a very strange juxtaposition between the Victorian aesthetic and the native aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, some dealers worked very hard to play the two, not against each other, but meld them.
Yeah, I mean, so, to the point of where there's sort of doggerel Victorian verse about the...
Oh, it's hideous.
Yeah, you print some of it in this catalog.
Yeah, I include a couple of those atrocious poems in there. They're pretty amusing, and they're actually pretty telling. And one of the early dealers was an English businessman in the Las Cruces area. He was from Mesilla Park, Francis E. Lester. And Lester, I think, hated the business, but he saw it as an opportunity, and he started at what's now New Mexico State University as the secretary and registrar, and he taught stenography. Lester became the biggest publisher of mail order literature in this field, and it was Native American, Mexican, Spanish, New Mexican. It was a number of different arts from different cultures that he was marketing, but all sort of representing the Southwest. And he conflated them sometimes.
Right.
But he had his own line of Indian blankets or rugs that he had some Tiwa people weaving for him in that area. He sold them as Pueblo Indian rugs. And in his marketing, he talks about, his words are something like, if you have ever seen a room decorated with mission-style furniture and Navajo rugs and other Indian artifacts, you cannot have helped but notice the harmonious combination of the colors and forms. And so he was trying to push Indian art into home decoration,
right,
playing on Victorian sensibilities, and it worked for him. He was hugely successful.
We're talking to Jonathan Batkin, and he is curator of the exhibition From the Railroad to Route 66, the Native American Curio Trade in New Mexico. How did it affect the Native people who were making these things, both culturally and economically, that there was such a huge demand for this stuff?
That really is the meat of the subject. And it's very complex. People, anthropologists, some of the educated people who came to Santa Fe, people interested in the arts and literature, really dismissed the curio trade as harmful, damaging to Native cultures, harmful to Pueblo and Navajo economies, and all of that probably is true, even to a large degree. I think, unfortunately, what happened in many cases is people also dismissed the makers of the objects as people who had made themselves somehow inauthentic, and there was something unpalatable to people, not just about the objects, but about the whole world of the curio trade, including the Pueblo and Navajo people who were involved in it. And by the 1920s, when the economy had shifted so much to a cash economy, and Pueblo and Navajo economies required that people seek wage labor, many young people coming out of the Indian schools, or even as students in the Indian schools, had no choice but to work in some of these shops, because the shops gave preference to Navajo and Pueblo youths to make silver. Much of the trade shifted towards the production of silver. And so Maisel's Indian Trading Post in Albuquerque and Southwest Arts and Crafts in Santa Fe are prime examples of this industry. There are many things I learned in the course of researching this project that I never knew and that I think had not really been published anywhere. I'm not aware of it. The Indian schools decided to start programs in the arts in the early 30s, and in 1931, three of the New Mexico Indian schools started programs in silversmithing. All of the instructors had worked in curio stores. Ambrose Roanhorse, who was later considered a great master, learned at Southwest Arts and Crafts in Santa Fe, or at least learned part of his trade there. Husky Johnson Burnside at Albuquerque had been a jeweler and a machinist for Maisel's in Albuquerque. And Fred Peschlikai at Fort Wingate had worked in a shop in Gallup, although he had learned traditional silversmithing as a child. The methods of the curio shops then got transferred to the Indian schools. There was a great uproar about that, you know, these guys were not teaching traditional methods of silversmithing in their classes. The federal government got involved trying to fight the mass production of jewelry, partially machine-made or entirely machine-made jewelry, because it also was killing traditional silversmithing. It was affecting Navajo and Pueblo economy. It became a complicated mess, really. But I think the one thing that's most interesting, which is a point I've tried to make very strongly in the exhibition, is we forget that many of the great master silversmiths of the second half of the 20th century, post-war, learned in the curio shops. So it's not just, there's no black and white here. It's
well, and it did really bring up the question for me of how long it takes something to go from being a commercial thing to being a traditional thing.
Correct.
And how long it takes a culture to internalize something as a tradition. That I was thinking about, so there's somebody on the air the other day who was talking about how Fiesta was such a deep and wonderful tradition. Well, Fiesta was revived for the tourists after 150 years of being dormant. So at first it was a tourist attraction, but now people, Fiesta, they've made it their own. And perhaps likewise with a lot of these crafts.
Yes, absolutely. There are, for example, beadwork from Zuni Pueblo was something started up by C.G. Wallace, who was a noted trader at Zuni. I interviewed him in the 80s, and he basically told me that it was getting to be very difficult to ship pottery safely. There were very few people making pottery, couldn't fill the demand for it on the market. So he started up what became this gigantic cottage industry at Zuni Pueblo making beadwork. And these are little human figures. Some of them are, you know, vertebrae of animals beaded to look like cows, steers' heads with the, you know, the vertebrae would, you know, parts would form the horns. And that is a tradition at Zuni now. It is not in anybody's mind linked to C.G. Wallace or anything around 1918. It is a tradition. And this stuff's fabulous. It's a wonderful folk art form.
Tell us about the actual shops themselves. We had the Gold family, who were European immigrants,
yes.
And then you had J.S. Candelario. And some of these folk passed themselves off as these great rugged adventurers, and a lot of that was salesmanship, it sounds like.
It's all salesmanship. Some of it a little more honest than in other cases. When the trade started in the Rocky Mountain region, excuse me, and this would have been as far north as southern Wyoming, but especially in the Denver area, all the earliest dealers were naturalists. And so many of these people actually were sort of adventurers. Martha Maxwell was a very famous hunter and taxidermist in Colorado,
right.
And she dealt in curios, mostly mineral specimens, but she probably also dealt in Native American objects. But many of these people, especially in the eastern United States, pass themselves off as, you know, you'd think the way they're dressed when they were photographed or had themselves depicted in an engraving or something, that they were hunters and trappers and, you know, men of the great wilds. But some of these guys never set foot in a wooded place in their life and never met an Indian. But they would speak with great authority of Native cultures.
And it was just to get people to buy stuff and to romanticize themselves as well as the Indians.
Right, they're confidence men. You know, it's pure salesmanship. And this translated in a different way in Santa Fe, where Jake Gold actually was a truly legendary salesman, and there are accounts of that dating back to the 1890s. And Candelario came to be viewed the same way. So there are stories about him, for example, that Teddy Roosevelt, on a visit to Santa Fe, hurried his breakfast coffee so he could go down and see and hear Candelario in action.
Now, there's an example in your book of one of the shops was renovated, and they made sure to renovate it in such a way that it looked old and right. crazy junkie as it was before, which is like, wow, the foe goes way back.
That's the 1890s. That's Jake Gold, yeah. who's really, in my mind, I mean, it's not like I obsess on Jake Gold just because he's my guy and I'm, you know, he's local. Jake Gold was a brilliant businessman. And in the early 1890s, the city was renovating, upgrading the look of downtown Santa Fe. We've reversed all that. We want right. it to look, you know, the lumpy mud look. We want that now. But that's not where boosters wanted Santa Fe to go in the 1890s. So in one of those efforts, he renovated his store, but he renovated it to look decrepit.
So what happened? I mean, what are the differences between what's going on in the plaza and the flea market and so on now versus what was happening then? What's the same and what's different?
I don't know that I can answer that as well as I should be able to, because I made a deliberate point of not going there with this project. I think an awful lot of dealers in the Native American arts field today think they operate in a way that's extremely different, but really it's the exact same thing. The way the objects are promoted is a little bit different. They're, you know, it's like going back to Francis Lester and home decoration. Now we view it as art, and these objects are great masterpieces in and of themselves. The market itself really has not changed much at all, but the way the objects are promoted to collectors is.
What's the difference?
It is pushing the individual object as art mm-hmm. more than anything. It's just the language. It's all language of promotion, all of it. The sales catalogs, there are hundreds of sales mail order catalogs dating back to the 19th century. And over time, you just see that the language just changes all the time. It's what you're going to call the object, how you're going to push it, who your market, you know, your target audience is. And every dealer's got a different target audience. So that the market really today is very much the same. And I think very few dealers recognize that. And it's nothing bad about it. It's just they don't see it.
These catalogs, these mail order catalogs survive. So there's a lot of documentation about this whole thing 100 plus years ago. Do the objects in those catalogs also survive?
In some cases. So for example, when we did the exhibition Clay People, we showed two astounding, huge human figurines from Cochiti that were made in 1880 or 81 and were photographed by Ben Wittick, who was a very famous photographer here. Those objects were in the inventory of Aaron Gold at that time. There are a number of other objects in that photograph, but we were able to find those two. One belongs to Princeton and one belongs to the University of Kansas. We have one of those in this show also. Now, those earliest catalogs were not illustrated. So, you know, that's the closest we could get to somebody having his inventory photographed for promotional
right.
purposes, and you're able to find the pieces. Otherwise, finding the actual objects illustrated in later catalogs is very, very difficult. We do have one example in the show. A famous trader of the Navajo Reservation, C.N. Cotton, put out a catalog on the use of Navajo blankets as home decoration, and there's a very beautiful Navajo rug illustrated in there, and this is probably the 1920s, early 20s, and that piece has been located, and we have that piece in the exhibition.
So it must have been fun and just really interesting to gather together all the objects and do the research for this show. I mean, you even have the ledger books of some of these curio shop dealers.
Yeah, those ledger books, it's interesting you'd mention them because I talk of them as being a sort of Rosetta Stone. That is, when Jake Gold and J.S. Candelario were partners from 1901 to 1903, one of those books is all of the incoming material ordered by Jake Gold through the network he had established starting in the early 1880s. And the other is the ledger documenting all the sales in the shop. Now, the sales were also done by Jake Gold, but they were all recorded by Candelario. So he's trying to control cash. And by using those ledgers, you can reconstruct a tremendous amount about Jake Gold's network, the mail order network, and you know the whole dealing network he had in the late 19th century.
Did he get wealthy doing this?
If he did, he lost it all gambling and through a lot of other bad habits. which eventually caught up to him, and he served time in prison. He died of syphilis.
What about Candelario?
Candelario became a significant landowner in Santa Fe.
So through this trade.
Through the trade.
Yeah.
He was one of, you know, by many accounts, and I cite plenty of examples, maybe one of the cheapest people ever. But if he could save a penny on a print job, he would save a penny.
Yeah.
And he owned a fair amount of property in Santa Fe by the time he died.
So how did you choose the items for this exhibition? Are they things that belong to the wheelwright?
No. Almost nothing in the exhibition belongs to the wheelwright, and that's typical. We originate all our shows and borrow almost everything we exhibit. This exhibition includes the vast majority of pieces that I could locate that are plainly documented to have gone through the hands of one or the other of these dealers. So every piece, really, it isn't just an example. It is a prime example. It is an example we know passed through somebody's hands on a very specific date, perhaps, right down to the very day that somebody sold a piece.
Yeah. The Wheelwright Museum is on Museum Hill, but it's not part of the state museum system. It's a private museum. Tell us about the Wheelwright.
The Wheelwright is the oldest private nonprofit museum in New Mexico. It's 70 years old, and it was one of the first two structures up on Museum Hill. The Laboratory of Anthropology preceded it by a few years, and the lab was a private institution initially. It was absorbed by the Museum of New Mexico many years later. But the Wheelwright, you know, it's a blessing to not be linked to government in some ways, and it's a curse in others because we don't get any funding from city or state or federal government for operating.
Right. And you originate all your exhibitions, and they don't travel. They can only be seen at the Wheelwright.
They can only be seen at the Wheelwright. Well, we occasionally will put an exhibition on the road. We've done that a few times. But the point is we don't take traveling exhibitions originated by any other institutions.
And the exhibitions like this one, I mean, people can buy and read the amazing catalog, but there's also a lot of text on the wall for people to read so they can understand what's going on.
Yeah, I tell anybody who's going, take your reading glasses.
It's pretty big print.
It's big print, but there is a lot of text, and it's still only a tiny bit of what's in the book, but we do believe in education for adults. That's something that we believe in very strongly, and we think a lot of institutions follow this wisdom that the typical visitor's attention span is a nanosecond, and you only put, you know, a sentence on the wall. And we find that even in these exhibitions where we have a tremendous amount of interpretive text, that the average visitor reads everything in the gallery.
That's so interesting. Now, the shop downstairs, which is a destination in itself, is that a curio shop?
It is, actually. Well, yes and no. It's based on a Navajo reservation prototype. That's not what my project is about. I do not have anything to say about trading on the Navajo reservation. This is purely an urban curio store project. But the Case Trading Post was modeled after a Navajo reservation trading post, and it's now 33 years old, and it is a destination in and of itself.
Jonathan Batkin is director of the Wheelwright Museum right here in Santa Fe, and he's curator of the exhibition From the Railroad to Route 66, the Native American Curio Trade in New Mexico, which is going to be at the Wheelwright through April of next year, and is author of this wonderful book that accompanies the exhibition, The Native American Curio Trade in New Mexico. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charles.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome John Malanfi. He is a member of St. Bede's Church, and he hails from the Christian Brothers tradition and is here to talk to us today about monasticism. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. I'm a longtime listener, and it's such a pleasure to be on the air here with you this morning.
Well, thank you. It's great to have you. And, you know, monasticism, people talk about monks' monasticism. What is a monk? It's a tradition that goes back millennia.
You're right, it does. All the way to the early Hindu and Buddhist traditions of the East. A monk is a person, could be a man or a woman, who has decided to get away from the world and practice contemplation, meditation, prayer, kind of go into the desert or go up to the mountain and live a life of abnegation. And there are so many types and varieties of monks even today. And I was invited by the adult education moderator at St. Bede to give a presentation on monasticism and religious orders, which I did in the spring. And I had such a great time researching it and finding out about it and preparing all my slides and PowerPoints and charts and graphs that I'm delighted to be here today to give you a little bit of it.
So why do, it's a tradition that crosses religion, crosses time, crosses geography. It's remarkably similar, I think, from one tradition to another, the monastic phenomenon, you know, the monastic practice. Why would anyone in their right mind do it? What for?
Well, to begin with, your expression, anyone in their right mind, also begs the question that what is right-mindedness?
Right.
To those people who decide they have the calling or vocation to become a monk or a nun or to join a religious order, to them that lifestyle and those beliefs would be definitely right-mindedness. So they think that they're in their right minds, and the rest of us maybe are missing something.
What is the purpose of it as affects themselves and as affects others? I mean, I can see people who join religious orders and go out and serve the poor, but people who join religious orders and sit by themselves in contemplation, what do they think they're doing for themselves and for the world?
Wow. Not being there myself, I don't know for sure, but my understanding is that the contemplative orders, say the Trappists and our wonderful Carmelites right over here towards Museum Hill, that's what they do. They remove themselves entirely and they live a complete life of abnegation. There's one little Carmelite whom I've met shopping, who goes out and does the grocery shopping for them and is the contact for the things they need. But why they would do that is based on the tradition of self-sacrifice and a mortification, where the belief is that by this intense practice of prayer and contemplation, that they would be, in a redemptive sense, helping the rest of us in terms of prayer and the mystical body of Christ and other theological and dogmatic concepts that they would follow. And other traditions besides Christianity have this also. The Buddhist monks, and why they would set themselves on fire during the Vietnam War and protest, and
why they would set themselves on fire, as distasteful as that may seem on a lot of levels and violent as it may seem, it's, you know, they're drawing attention to themselves and to a problem. And regular monasticism is so not that. It's so not drawing attention to oneself. And one wonders what is the nature of the transaction of between the monk and the rest of the world through prayer, through whatever it is they're doing.
Through prayer and self-sacrifice and mortification, the belief in the tradition is that they are scoring points, accumulating grace, earning credits that would be doing good for the rest of us. But that is a very, very small part of monasticism. The extreme contemplative orders are, I'd say today, pretty marginal, and probably always were.
What's the greater part of it?
The greater part of it is the active monasteries. If you read a wonderful author like Thomas Cahill, who has this wonderful book entitled How the Irish Saved Western Civilization,
right.
Which of course they did. And it was the Irish monks who began their Celtic tradition, and they were different in a couple of ways. First, they were always connected to the people. They were not at all contemplative. They did not remove themselves. They were farming. They were the scientists. They were developing the water. They were doing all kinds of wonderful things in their 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries at the height of the Irish monasticism.
So in that sense, they were the church was playing the role of the university and the monks of professors, in a way.
Yes, the first university as such was founded in Italy, and the Irish monks who had emigrated to the continent played a big part in that. The big monastery at Bobbio led to the Bologna and the university system that arose in the Renaissance, based on the High Middle Ages. But it was the Irish monks who were really the scientists, the inventors, the cutting-edge people of their time, who shared it with the people, lived with the people, tilled the land with the people. The church in Ireland was not based on the Roman model of the empire, the diocese, the authoritarian, the episcopacy, the bishops. It wasn't that way at all. The Irish monks were the clergy. The Irish monks lived in the land with everybody else. They had their monasteries, and it was a much closer knit community. And they were not at all away from the people. They were with the people.
Now, is celibacy, has that always been a part of the monastic way?
No. Interestingly enough, it hasn't been. There were joint monasteries of men and women, and of course there was always a married clergy. In the Jewish tradition, in order to become a full-fledged rabbi, you have to be married. They wouldn't, they'd look askance at a single guy trying to tell him something when,
Because the whole advice giving
to
the family is part of that job.
Play it a game, make it a rules. That's
right.
The way it is. But in terms of celibacy, it, again, is a Western phenomenon based on follow the money. If there were these wives and children, then the church would have to pay for them out of the coffers. So the simpler thing was to literally get rid of the women, which they did in a very unchivalric way when the celibacy rule began and was enforced. And that ensured that the church revenues would be protected, and
Is that around the same time that orders of convents and orders of nuns arose?
No, I don't believe so. I believe the idea of the desert fathers and the Greek desert fathers like Antony, going back to Alexandria and the great traditions coming out of the Greek East and Alexandria. That's what led to the adoption by these new people, the Christians, and their own monks went out into the desert and up onto the mountain and to Mount Carmel and the Carmelites and the Irish monks. The Irish monks arose in Ireland about the same time as Benedict in Italy. Benedict of Nursia founded a Monte Cassino, which was there for 1,000 years until the Allies had to bomb it because the Nazis took it over as a fortification during the invasion. But the Benedictines and the Irish monks were kind of concurrent. Now, the Benedictines were always quieter. They were always in the Roman tradition. They were not with the people the way the Irish monks were. So even though the Irish monks coming in through France, Switzerland, and Italy made a big impact, especially in Milan. St. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, was educated by Irish monks. St. Martin of Tours was educated by Irish monks. So their tradition was quite different. And there were big battles going on in the church then, not unlike, you know, I mean, religion and battles have always been together pretty much.
Speaking of which, there's the Reformation. Well, go ahead.
And how? Reformation, as I like to call it, yeah.
So how did the Reformation, which was basically Martin Luther, the rise of Protestantism, huge split from the Catholic Church, how did that affect the whole monastic tradition?
Well, I don't want to say it almost wiped it out, but Henry VIII, in his zeal to establish the English Church, and his disappointment over getting his annulments and divorces, if you will, he literally emptied out the monasteries and the convents and took over all the church lands, which was another thing. If you follow the money, even today, here in our wonderful USA, the Roman Catholic Church is the biggest single landowner in the country.
Is that right?
I believe so, yeah. And of course they're not paying taxes on that stuff. So in Henry's time that got to be a problem because all the counts and dukes and whatnot who were paying the king's taxes didn't like that. So when the other excuse of Anne Boleyn and the marriages and whatnot came up, it was real easy for Henry to say, okay guys, you're out, I'm in. I'll be the head of the Christian church in England, will cut off any relations with the papacy, and the land is ours. And the lands were good because the monastery lands had always been very productive. The Cistercians did a wonderful job in turning otherwise barren land into very productive farms and irrigation systems and whatnot.
So when we look at monasticism today in, for example, the United States and Europe, I know that there are monks who train German shepherds. There are monks who make wine, who make grape jelly. I mean, what are monks doing?
Just about everything. In terms of today, education is a big thing. Health and hospitals are a big thing. Those are two, you know, large areas. Most of the educational facilities in the world, if they're not run by the state as public universities, are run by religious orders or monks. My own three sons were trained in Dallas, Texas by the monks of the Cistercian order. These were Hungarian Cistercians who fled the Russian tanks in Budapest in 56, wound up in Texas, established the University of Dallas, and then their own Cistercian prep school, which is a leading top academic school, one of the best in the country.
Do you think it's still a calling for the men and women who do it versus I think at one point it was a viable career choice because the church just had so much money and power. It was like a career choice, like becoming a scientist or a auto repair person. What about now?
It's a little different now because there are so many more options for young men and women. But back in the medieval times in the Renaissance, a family with a lot of children would know that, well, let's see, we'll have one that will try to educate and try to make a go of it, maybe some tradesmen, maybe one for the law if they're upper middle class, always at least one or two for the church. And they even had a name for it. They were called gifts, which is oblatio. So the oblates, the oblate children at a very young age were committed to a lifetime of service in the church, usually as a monk or a nun.
Are there cases of their rebelling against that?
I'm sure it happened, although the cases are certainly not publicized. They wouldn't be publicized by the church, naturally. And the people themselves would want to stay under the radar, so you don't hear too much about that.
So, John Melamphy, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. The time has gone very quickly talking about monasticism. Are you going to be giving any more lectures or educational programs on the subject?
I hope so. I'm certainly open to invitation and would love to do it. It's been a real treat today. I thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. John Melamphy is a member of St. Bede's Church, talking to us about monasticism. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan will feature some new releases. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us speaking of the arts, and it'll be the 4th of July. We're going to be broadcasting live from the plaza. So, hey, if you're down there for the pancake breakfast, come by the KSFR booth and see us. Hasta la vista. Ciao.
The National Organization for Women has been concerned with a myriad of issues affecting women since 1966. Your Santa Fe chapter of NOW is active dealing with reproductive rights, equal pay, and Social Security. It welcomes new members always. If you would like to become involved with this vital chapter and realize how these and other issues affect us more than ever before, attend a monthly meeting. Call 982-1823.
In touch with our community, KSFR Santa Fe.